To turn to the estates for first, during the later Middle Ages, regional estates had often played a very active part in government. They were composed of representatives of the clergy, the first estate, the nobility, the second estate, and the third estate, which was everybody else, but which in practice meant urban interests, because as we talked about before, the peasants are generally left out of the equation. After the mid-15th century, the influence of these provincial estates, these provincial regional assemblies, tends to decline, especially in the north of France. Many of them disappear completely, or they go into permanent recess, or they lose their power to control taxation, which is an essential foundation of the power of an estate. In those parts of France without estates, taxation from the late 15th century onwards is now administered by royal officials. These officials are usually called élus, which makes it sound like they were elected, which is actually nonsensical. They were handpicked by the crown. And the estates lost their role in approving the taxes. But nevertheless, where provincial estates survive, insofar as they are an institution where the monarchy consults with the subjects, and insofar as they are a forum where people can vent their grievances, they do become important forums for dissent. The courts, the second major institution I'd like to talk about, are probably more significant. The most prestigious of all these parlements is the Parlement of Paris, which has jurisdiction over about roughly half of France. The Parlement of Paris scrutinized the legislation of the Royal Council. It could actually request amendment of any royal law before registering an edict on the grounds that it conflicted with established precedent. In a sense, therefore, the Parlement of Paris can be seen as acting on this direct check on the legislative power of the crown. It is true that it was difficult for these courts in the long run to avoid the ultimate logic of dependence on the monarchy. The basic idea was that they administered the justice of the king, they didn't create it, and this made it impossible for them to totally block what the king wanted to do. If, for example, the Parlement remonstrated, as it was called, with the monarch, objected to an edict, the king could command them with a document, a letter of command, usually known as a lettre de jugement. He could command them to register, that is to say, make effective his law. And if the Parlement decided to dig in its heels and resist even further, the monarch could overrule the Parlement with a ceremony which is called the bed of justice, or lit de justice, maybe couch or sofa of justice. Sounds a little bit less dignified, it's a bit more accurate. That is to say, the monarch would personally appear in the court and command them solemnly to register the edict. But I should say that even though the monarch could always ultimately override the objections of the Parlement, this always required the expenditure of considerable political capital. After all, the monarchy still needed these courts to administer his justice. And in practice, therefore, by just being obstreperous and protesting and creating red tape, the Parlement of Paris in particular could be a serious obstacle to the wishes of the crown. Moreover, there's also the other half of France where the Parlement of Paris doesn't have jurisdiction. And here, there were regional parlements. There were seven of them, all established between 1443 and 1554. These provincial parlements were active in resisting seigneurial justice. They were also capable of defending provincial interests against royal governors or even against the crown directly. For example, in 1548, the Parlement of Bordeaux in southwestern France supported a huge rural uprising against the salt tax. You remember this hated salt tax. In sum, therefore, the power of the king was very great. There's no getting around that. And it would be idle to deny that between 1450 and 1550, the monarchy becomes much, much more powerful. But, nevertheless, when all is said and done, it must be stressed that the monarch, for all of his elaborate claims, could never rule like a despot in practice. He always had to take account of the wishes of the aristocracy, and in particular, of these powerful institutions. Now, having talked about institutions which can resist or make life difficult for the monarchy, we need to talk about the second general stumbling block to the power of the crown, and this was the rise of new personal intermediary forces in the place of the feudal magnates of the Middle Ages. The challenge, and this is an aristocratic challenge, was not really based anymore on sub-infeudation. It was based, as I mentioned earlier, on a clientage network, usually the clientage network of a provincial governor. The provincial governor in France was the representative of the crown in the provinces. He was invariably an aristocrat, and his broad function was military. His obligations were to guard the province, to defend it. He often held specific commissions in the area of finance or of administration. And the patronage available to him was really quite considerable. It wasn't the same as the patronage available to, you know, a prince of the 15th century or a semi-independent feudal noble. But nonetheless, there was patronage there. People could establish client networks. And these client networks, although they're often dressed up in dignified language, often take on the overtones of a kind of a mafia. It's a large sort of back-scratching protection racket kind of organization. The provincial governor could attract a following from the local nobility. He could seek clients at court and on the royal council. Crucially, in any time of weakness on the part of the crown, whenever there was monarchic weakness, this allowed these aristocratic factions to become correspondingly more powerful. They were always aware of the possibilities of pressing their advantage in any time there was a weakness of the crown. And during the 1540s and during the 1550s in particular, the royal court came to be divided into rival factions. And in this period, it was the provincial governors in particular who provided the territorial basis for the rivalry of the great aristocratic houses. In other words, what has happened by the mid-16th century is that provincial governors have become threats to, rather than instruments of, the authority of the monarchy.